Welcome to the Glenn Show.
Thank you for having me, man. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's really good to have you. This is Glenn Lowry of Brown University and bloggingheads.tv here at the Glenn Show. And it's a pleasure to welcome Dr. Carl Hart, who is Associate Professor of Psychology and Psychiatry at Columbia University, and who is an expert in the field of neuropsychopharmacology, which was a new one on me, Carl, I must say, when I read that. That's a long title for what must be a complex expertise. And who, Carl, has written a book called High Price, about the way in which we think about and try to regulate the use of drugs in American society from the perspective of his life experience and his professional expertise as a neuropsychopharmacologist. So we have a great opportunity here to talk with you, Carl, about your book, and welcome to the Glenn Show again.
Thank you for having me, man. I just want to say just a word about neuropsychopharmacology.
It's
a simple sort of thing. When you think about neuro, it just means the study of the brain, and psycho means behavior, basically consciousness, and then pharmacology, drugs. So it's the study of drugs on the brain and behavior, basically.
Okay, so I want to give you a chance to tell our viewers about this book and about your ideas. I want to just start by saying, I read your book and I was stunned by the force of it, both by the poignant profoundly revealing memoir dimension of the book, in which you talk about your own life and it's moving in powerful ways, but also by this, you know, mission that it's very clear that you're on to try to counter what you take to be a lot of mythology and just simply, you know, false information that is driving drug policy in the country and it's doing a lot of damage. So I'd be grateful if you could get us started in this conversation by, you know, just sort of sketching some of the main themes in the book, and we can use that as a point of departure.
Yeah, so you point out that I'm on, like, this mission that we can start there. I just want to say quickly, though, you know, as I think about this mission, there have been people like yourself. I mean, I read your stuff, and I remember, I think I shot you an email recently when you did an op-ed at, I think, 09, 010 in the Times, and you were talking about this issue related to incarceration. So people like your work and other people's work inspire people like me who come at it from a different angle. I am a neuroscientist, as you say, but ultimately, you, me, and people like us are far and few. There are few Black men in the academy, and so that means that sometimes the research agenda within the academy doesn't focus on those issues that concern people that look like me or people I care about. And so I've been watching you all out here for years, and so I'm just trying to make my contribution with my skill set. And my skill set is the study of drugs. And I study drugs from a biological perspective, but if you do that from a biological perspective, you got to understand the context in which these behaviors occur. And context makes you think about society and the social interactions. And so I'm just trying to get better at studying all of these factors. And when you study all of these factors, then you start to see that much of what we do in terms of public education, public policy, drug treatment, much of what we do is just inconsistent with the evidence. And when you're trained to look at the evidence and let the evidence dictate your position, that's deeply disturbing, especially when you start to see things like the racial injustices that occurs. And so I'm just trying to make my contribution just like you all have made yours and continue to.
Well, okay. Thanks for the personal statement of appreciation. It's very much appreciated on this end. But I don't know nothing from neuropsychopharmacology. So, what would a primer, what would the outline of a primer look like here? Everything that you thought was true about drugs that's not true, or stuff that's true about drugs that you need to know that you don't know? How would you outline that?
Well, let's think about just some simple facts. One of the things that I was taught when I was starting to study drugs and I was coming up, actually, is that most of the people who use a drug like crack cocaine are addicted to that drug. And that's just simply not true. The vast majority of the people who use crack cocaine are not addicted. They go to work. They're responsible people. We see this throughout our society. That's one thing. And then another thing as it relates to neuroscience is that when you take these kind of drugs, some of the sort of mythology or the narrative had been that these drugs screw up your functioning of your brain cells. And then when you look at the data and you try and find this, yeah, you certainly can get some toxic effects from drugs like cocaine or methamphetamine. But the doses that are required to get those toxic effects are 10, 20, 30, 40 times the doses that humans normally take. So when you take a drug like acetaminophen, you can certainly get some toxicity, especially with the liver. When you take it 10, 20, 30 times the amount that you're supposed to take it, yeah, it's toxic. So if cocaine is only toxic at those extreme doses, why do we operate only in the extreme when we're talking about public education or public policy? It would be like us doing the same thing with acetaminophen. It doesn't make any sense.
But one, acetaminophen is an over-the-counter, commonly used drug called, what would be the trade name?
Tylenol is the trade name.
Oh, Tylenol. Okay, yeah, got it.
So if we said these things about Tylenol, people would look at you as if you're making no sense. But we say it all the time with drugs like cocaine, methamphetamine. Yeah, these drugs can be potentially toxic, but taken in the doses that humans take them, toxicity is rare.
Okay, so I think it's probably worth explaining to anybody who's listening to this that if I got this right, what you're saying is based on the fact that the findings of the toxicity of these drugs derived from animal studies in which the amount of the drug that the animal ingests is relative to body weight or some other such measure, large, very large, relative to the amount of drugs that humans in ordinary usage ingest. And there's no reason to think that the effect on humans of their use at the relatively low level that they are observed to use would be the same as the effects found in a laboratory with animals who have been forced to ingest significantly larger, proportionately larger quantities of the drug.
Absolutely. And just a quick practical example. Take a drug like nicotine, which is in tobacco cigarettes. You take a drug and you take 50 milligrams of nicotine, will kill about half of the people who take that drug. 50 milligrams of cocaine will give you a nice buzz, but certainly would not approach death or anything like that. But nicotine is a drug that is prevalent in our society. We know how to use it safely. But we talk about cocaine like it's so toxic. By the way, this is not an endorsement for people to go out and use cocaine.
Of course not.
It's just the reality of the situation so people can see how misleading we have been with our public education surrounding these things.
Yeah, I'm reminded, and you mentioned it in your book, of this fabled television commercial that we used to see about this is your brain on drugs, showing an egg frying in a pan, and the suggestion to kids being that if you use drugs, this is what will happen to your brain. And you're saying that that's just unscientific propaganda for which there's no basis in evidentiary fact.
Absolutely. That does more harm than the drugs themselves, because one of the things that you do is that you are now discouraging critical thinking. You're just telling people to accept something uncritically. And that's certainly not the kind of education or knowledge that or way that I want to educate my children. My children, all of these things are on the table for evidence to dictate their positions.
Okay. So if I'm getting this right, one part of the story is that the public understanding of the effects of drug use is off base and overestimates the deleterious effects of moderate usage of, I don't want to put words in your mouth, I just want to understand what the point is, overstates the negative effects of moderate usage in the interest of trying to discourage people from using altogether.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, the public discourse certainly overstates and exaggerates the potential harm associated with these drugs. Now, when you say in the interest to discourage moderate use, I mean, it's more than just in the interest of the discouraged drug use. It's in the interest of people's pockets. I mean, there's a lot of money in miseducating the public about drugs. So we think about this fact. Each year, we spend $26 billion a year to fight this war on drugs. About 70% of that goes to law enforcement budgets. And this approach that we are currently doing. And then what law enforcement doesn't get, we have people like treatment providers get. I mean, and so it's like, if you don't go to jail when you go to treatment, the vast majority of people don't need either. And so there is money in this miseducation. Otherwise, it wouldn't continue.
Confession, I am a recovering crack cocaine addict. Let me put that addict part in quotes. 27 years ago, I got into a lot of trouble with cocaine. I ended up in treatment. I quote recovered. Close quote, and I no longer use crack cocaine. I did, and I got into trouble with it. In the recovery process, abstinence was stressed as an absolute bedrock principle. I mean, I know you know this, right? It was basically 10 steps, 12 steps, AA, going to meetings, you know, and not using. And a little bit of using wasn't okay.
Sure.
So if you tell me most people are not addicts, maybe that doesn't apply to the 10 or 15 or 20% of us who are, and maybe you'd have a different prescription. But it just makes me think that maybe abstinence isn't absolutely necessary in order for people to be able to get over the problem of abuse or what. I mean, I'm kind of confused about that based on what you're saying.
But don't be confused. Don't be confused. The point that I'm trying to make here is that you're absolutely abstinent is not required. I mean, that's, again, some religion that we kind of took from a time before. But when you look at the empirical evidence, there's no empirical evidence that says abstinence is required. Now, I should say, though, whenever you talk about these things and you think about people's personal drug use and that sort of thing, if abstinence is working for an individual, that's great. But that is not evidence that it works or it's the only way, the only thing that works. In fact, the evidence shows that people can use in moderation, even in treatment. There has been some evidence for that. But the abstinence-only model is more religion than evidence or science.
Well, that's going to be news to the AA community, isn't it?
Of course. It's news to a number of people. I mean, but I don't – that's not my major concern. My major concern is what does the evidence say?
What about you're a psychologist, so forgive me. I'm not. But what about the idea that – even if it's not biologically or physiologically necessary, that it's somehow psychologically necessary for individuals to not go back to, you know, their old ways of drinking or drugging to an extent that actually was injurious to their families and to themselves, to their health, to their ability to live a normal life. So most of these people who come into these programs are seeking to try to recover from something that's killing them. And this religious, if it is a religious idea of abstinence, nevertheless fixes their minds and allows them to maybe marshal their resources of self-control to an extent that they would not, maybe, I don't know, you say it's the evidence, so tell me about the evidence, wouldn't be able to do if they were to not abstain.
Well, again, like I said, if it's working for people, that's fine. They should do what they will. But think about this. You just said 27 years ago, you had this issue. 27 yeah. years ago, you were a younger man, probably a stupider man. So as we get older, we don't make the same mistakes that we did. I mean, I certainly, in the book, I described a lot of drama, a lot of things that I engaged in. Not some of them were drugs, but certainly not a drug problem. But there were other issues that I had, and we do as young people. And then we just kind of mature out of those things as a result of experience, as a result of more responsibilities, as a result of a wide range of things. But what people say, they take that as evidence. It's like, I have been clean for 25 years or 30 years, and you know, I cannot touch another hit of cocaine or what have you. Well, maybe that's good for you. But that's not it. There have been a number of things that happen over the maturation process that also impacts your ability to be more responsible and behave in a way that you think is acceptable or appropriate for you. So that's all I'm saying.
Can you talk a little bit more about this point? I think it comes through very clearly in your book, and it's really important. You're a scientist. You study the workings of the brain and the effects on human behavior of people taking certain substances via its effect on their brain. And you say that can only take us so far in understanding the phenomenon of addiction, which, if I get you right, you say, is not simply a biological or physiological phenomenon, but it's also a phenomenon that needs to be understood in the social context in which people are living. So if this is right, what I'm saying here, can you expand on this point? I mean, what is addiction? How is it more than by, you know, looking for the explanation for addiction in the brains of people, if I read you correctly, is a fool's errand. You won't find it there, at least not only there.
That's right. There is when we think about brain disease and those sorts of things, we have some classic brain disease. You think about Alzheimer's disease. If you look in the brains of people who have Alzheimer's, you can see clearly that these plaques in certain areas of the brain, and that indicative of Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease. You can see this loss of dopamine in a certain region of the brain. So there are some brain diseases that you see this neuropathology, and it manifests in behaviorally. With drug addiction, there is no such thing. You can't look at somebody's brain and say, oh, this person's a drug addict. There is just simply no evidence of that anywhere. But we talk like there is. So as we think about what drug addiction is, there are no neural markers of drug addiction. For drug addictions, our best marker right now is the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association. There are a list of symptoms, that about 11 symptoms that people have, that they list, and people have to endorse anywhere from like 2 to more than 8 to determine whether or not they meet criteria for this thing, as we call casually addiction, but we call it substance use disorder in the field. And the list of these symptoms include things like several unsuccessful attempts to cut down or control your drug use, using more of the drug than intended or for a longer period of time than intended, using the drug when it disrupts or seriously impairs your ability to meet social obligation, educational obligations, occupational obligations, tolerance, where you need more of the drug to have an effect might be there, but it's not necessary. Or withdrawal, where when you don't have the drug anymore, you have some symptoms that are unpleasant. None of these things are necessary, but they might be there. So there's this list, and you go down the list, but the list mainly focuses on psychosocial disruptions. Are you meeting your obligations? And are you disturbed by this, or it's so disturbing that you're trying to do something about it?
So this is the kind of thing that would lead you to say that most users of, let me say, crack cocaine are not addicts, because most of them would not be able to check off 3 or 4 or 5 of those boxes.
Yeah, and we've had this data for every year, the federal government, we collect these large surveys. And so this data has been known for 30 years or so. This is not anything radical. I'm not the only one saying it. People have been publishing these data forever.
Now, what about the argument that I can imagine somebody, I have a friend called Mark Kleiman, he's a public policy guy, does drug policy at UCLA.
Sure, I know.
I don't know if you've seen his work. You should.
I do.
So I can hear him right now bouncing off the walls. I can see him bouncing off the walls, and I can hear him shouting out, yeah, but we got the Pareto law, 80-20 rule, or whatever it is, you know, the biggest 20% of the users are going to account for 80% of the use. And Hart can be right that, you know, the median user is not going to be an addict according to his strict definition, but there's still these 20% out there or so. Who are going to get into trouble and moreover make trouble for the rest of us. And then he'd go on to observe that when they do surveys of people who've been taken in at Rikers Island or somewhere, they find that X percent of them have used cocaine or marijuana in the last 48 hours, whatever, you know, the kind of statistic to say it's not the typical user. It's the heavily dependent and problematic user who may not be the median of the population, but who is a non-trivial portion of the population and et cetera.
Yeah, Mark would be absolutely right. I mean, and so we say the same thing about alcohol. Yeah, I mean, about 15% of the people who use alcohol will become an alcoholic. That's a fact. And the people who get into trouble with alcohol use, it's only a small portion of the alcoholic drinkers. About the top 10% of drinkers account for most of the problems related to alcohol. He's absolutely right. But does that mean that the rest of these people, the rest of us, should be punished harshly and severely because of this smaller percentage who have the problems? We can think about driving an automobile in the same way. We can think about sexual behavior in the same way. So I absolutely agree with him. The question becomes, do you punish the larger majority for the smaller minority who can't handle their drug use for whatever reason? What I conclude from that is that the problem is not the drugs. If the majority of the folks do so safely and they're fine, the problem has to do with those individuals. Maybe those individuals, social settings, social networks, or what have you, a variety of sort of things, but not the drugs themselves.
Yeah. Okay. So the question here then would be, observing that there are a substantial minority, say 20%, who might get into serious trouble, what's the implication of that fact for the way in which we would want to control and regulate drug use in the general population? And a punitive regime that's very heavy-handed and aims toward, in effect, abolition of use is far too costly for whatever benefited for the 80%, for whatever benefit it might generate for the 20%.
That's right. That's exactly right. And that's the point. You know, it's one of the reasons that I wrote the book is because people were trying to have me write a book about addiction. And I didn't want to write a book about addiction because the action is not within the people who are addicted. The action is in the other 80 to 90%. That's where the action is. Why should this small minority exert all of this influence on our thinking about drugs? This is what has happened in the country.
Now, I've noticed something. I'm reminded here listening to you something that's been attributed to the late political scientist James Q. Wilson, who's very influential in writing about crime control policy in the United States, not specifically about drugs, but I'm sure he had something to say about it. But in any case, one of his laudatory obituaries observed that he had made the observation that tobacco shortens one's life, but cocaine debases it. Okay, so he had drawn a distinction between the drug nicotine and the drug and whatever else is in tobacco that would, you know, the tars and all this stuff that might affect your lungs, and the drug cocaine. Cocaine debases your life. See, tobacco just shortens it. Okay, so there was a moralistic dimension to that. There was a statement about character. Smoking a cigarette, not inconsistent with having character. Free basis of cocaine, well, you know, that's way out there on the boundaries of legitimate human behavior. And this idea that the use of some, you know, people have been imbibing substances that alter the state of consciousness for in every society as long as, you know, you're the expert, but I mean, my understanding is that this is a ubiquitous phenomenon in human society, but that some ways of affecting our mood or our consciousness are taken to be consistent with decency and other ways are a debasement of our humanity. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, I think you just explained it nicely. I mean, it's moralism. I mean, it frustrates the hell out of me when I hear those kinds of things, because again, you're now acting as if these drugs somehow have even human characteristics. But we're really talking about the association. I mean, who is that drug use associated with? It becomes a sophisticated way for us to actually talk poorly about people who we hold in poor regard without actually saying those people's names. That's what it really becomes about, because, you know, when we think about cocaine, the current guy who occupies the White House, Barack Obama, he did his fair share of cocaine. I mean, whatever you think about him as a president, he certainly is probably one of the smarter guys who's occupied the White House. I mean, we can think whatever we want about his policies. Right. But when you think about him doing a job just like anybody else who has had that position, he's doing about as well as the rest of those guys. And so if you think about cocaine debasing him, it's ridiculous. Or you think about just the wide range of people in you. We're sitting here I'm talking to you. And I think about all of the things that you've written and all of the things that we've learned from you. And it just doesn't make any sense.
I'll tell you a story. I was out of rehab maybe 18 months, and these were my neoconservative years, and it was the early 1990s. It was probably 1990, maybe 1989. But in any case, I'm at a cocktail party, okay, in Washington, D.C., and there's a bunch of neocons hanging around. And in fact, it was the publication committee meeting for the Public Interest magazine, which was, you know, a big influential neoconservative magazine in those years. And there was Bill Bennett, the drug czar under President
Bush,
George Herbert Walker Bush, if I remember correctly. Yeah. And he had a tumbler of scotch, and the brother was downing it gulp after gulp. Okay. Now I'm just out of rehab. I'm abstaining, right? I've got soda water in my glass. I'm trying to recover. I'm holding on by my fingernails. Oh, I don't want to go back to the crack house. I don't want to go back to crack house. And this guy is just downing the scotch like it was Coke. And I thought, this is bizarre in the extreme. This is surreal. I mean, this should be in a movie somewhere. You know, this scene should be in the movie because this, it captured all of the kind of unreflective and unthinking hypocrisy, you know, that was implicit. I mean, I don't mean this personally. I don't mean this against Bill Bennett. I'm just saying the image of the drug czar drinking scotch whiskey like it was water.
Yeah. And if we really start to talk about the potential toxicity of drugs, all these drugs that we're talking about, heroin, cocaine, crack, whatever, methamphetamine, alcohol, of all of those drugs, the only one that someone can die from an alcohol, from a withdrawal syndrome, is alcohol. And then when you think about alcohol, so alcohol is certainly a potentially dangerous compound, but we have had massive public education campaigns. We control the dosing of alcohol. We know how to decrease the harms associated with alcohol, and we know how to enhance the potential benefits of alcohol, because we know that alcohol does have some potential benefits, particularly when you talk about functions like the one you just described. Because I know if I was there, give me a drink.
You're going to need a couple of drinks.
I'm telling you, because it's great to relieve the anxiety that those people invoke in me. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's like when we think about drug effects, if we think about it honestly and from a neurobiological perspective, cocaine is not as bad as the general public thinks it is.
Mm. Cocaine is not as bad. Okay. Do you want to amplify?
Oh, well, I mean, certainly when we think about, let's just think about cocaine and what it does for people who use cocaine. You use cocaine sometimes to enhance your sort of social interactions with other people. You use it at a party. It has a short half-life, short-lived. So that means that you use it at a party, then you can go home and sleep. Not like amphetamines. If you're using that at a party, it lasts so long, some of the effects last so long that you can't sleep that night. So when we think about if people were smarter in the society about the drugs in which they use, they would take cocaine if they need to get up the next morning, as opposed to taking an amphetamine that evening. And so you can use it just – I mean, I don't think your public needs me to tell them that you can use cocaine safely and to enhance social interaction and enhance human function. I think people know that. That's why they use it, despite the fact that it's illegal. They're not stupid.
Yeah. Okay. So these drugs, these illegal drugs, cocaine, heroin, methamphetamines, ecstasy, marijuana, others – they have properties and they have impacts on people. And some of those effects are, quote, good, close quote. That is to say, desirable. They are effects that people might want to ingest the substance in order to induce in themselves. And we've got a lot of medicines on the list. Some of them require prescriptions. Some of them don't, that do just that.
That's right. That's
exactly and
right.
You seem to be saying there's no reason that these things that we have on the illegal side of the line need to be, that line itself is questionable somehow, that sharp line that people want to draw between this half dozen illegal substances and the other ones that we're using.
Put it this way, the body does not make a distinction between what's legal and what's illegal. That's a human sort of endeavor, but the body and the brain does not make that distinction. When we think about methamphetamine actually is a drug that is legal in this country. It's used to treat obesity and to treat attention deficit disorder. It's prescribed. We think about cocaine. Without cocaine, we don't have Novocaine. Novocaine is just a modification of the cocaine structure. Cocaine is also used in surgeries as a vasoconstrictor. It's short-lived, some minor surgeries. Think about heroin. Heroin is essentially the same drug as morphine. It's just morphine with two acid groups attached to it. Yeah. It's a great pain reliever. And if someone has diarrhea, it can save your life. You know, so the body doesn't make these sort of distinctions that we make here as a society. And when we think about heroin in our country, heroin is vilified. But when we think about other places like Switzerland, for example, where I just retired from, they use heroin as a form of treatment for heroin addiction. And you know what? They've been doing it for more than 20 years, and it's a successful treatment. They're happy
with it. More successful than methadone?
For some people, absolutely. It is a successful treatment.
Yeah. Okay, well, so I think it's my responsibility to ask you, at least to sketch briefly, what your alternative drug control regime would look like. If not this, which is the prohibition of sale and use, possession of heroin and cocaine, and in many places, marijuana. What? If not this, what? Has any other jurisdiction, any other country, Holland, Portugal, Switzerland, gotten it right? I mean, what would the drug control laws look like if you had your way?
Well, the major thing I argue for in the book in the last chapter is that I try to lay out this sort of drug education. So we need to really change the way we educate people in the country about drugs. We need to get smarter to make sure that we help keep people safe. That's number one. But number two, the thing that I argue for is complete decriminalization of drug possession. Portugal, the Czech Republic, they have already done this. Czech Republic has done this since their late 1990s. Portugal has done it since 2001. Both of those countries' drug use are lower or about the same as their EU neighbors. They're doing well, except that they don't have these large numbers of people incarcerated for drugs like our country. So I'm arguing for complete drug decriminalization, but I have to explain the difference between drug decriminalization and drug legalization. Legalization is what we do with alcohol and tobacco. You can sell it, you can purchase it if you're of age with no consequences. Whereas decriminalization would be decriminalization of possession would be like treating possession offenses just like we treat traffic violations. Well, yeah. you can't. Well, you might get a fine, or maybe not, but you certainly will not be criminally prosecuted. You don't get a criminal record, and drug sales still remain illegal. But the reason why I'm arguing for decriminalization mostly is because that if we decriminalize drugs today, it would have a huge impact. When you consider this fact, each year we arrest 1.5 million people for drug-related crimes, and 80% of those are for simple possession. Would have a huge impact. And so people say, well, why not go as far as arguing for legalization?
Right.
Legalization, I certainly am not opposed to legalization. My major concern is that I'm not so much concerned about the drug effects. I'm more concerned about the hysteria that will result as a result, after legalization. We're seeing some of this in Colorado and Washington with those states recently legalized marijuana. We're seeing some of this hysteria. Maureen Dowd did a piece. Did a piece about a month or two ago in the Times about basically the dangers of marijuana because she was not very smart and took a large dose of THC, and she's an amateur and a novice, taking a large dose, and she was debilitated for about 8 hours, and she's arguing that this indicates that these drugs are dangerous. We already know all psychoactive drugs, alcohol, tobacco, are potentially dangerous. That's why one has to be a responsible person if they engage in any psychoactive use. You can't be stupid. And so those kind of stories, I worry they will be even more plentiful if we legalize without the proper occasion, the proper education. One of the thing that's nice things that have been happening as a result of her column, a large part of the population have been saying things like, this is stupid. You don't take that large of a dose. So you can't fool people with this sort of hysteria like we did in the 1930s with marijuana. And so we need to make sure we increase the education surrounding cocaine, heroin, and the rest of these drugs in the same way we have with marijuana.
Let me see if I understand. You want to use decriminalization as a way station or a stopping point on the way toward legalization, giving us time enough to educate people so that legalization would not generate the dangers of the ignorant misuse of the substances? That's a question I'm asking.
Yeah, certainly. I see decriminalization as an intermediary step to legalization, possibly. But it also gives the society an opportunity to determine how they want to regulate each of these substances. So society may decide that, hey, cocaine won't be regulated in the same way as marijuana, or heroin won't be regulated in the same way as methamphetamine. So it gives the society an opportunity to be smart about its drug regulation.
Would you draw a distinction between marijuana on the one hand and cocaine and heroin on the other with respect to legalization and decriminalization?
No, I would not. But right now, with the ignorance in the population, yes, I would. But once the society gets educated, certainly knows as much as I know about these drugs, I wouldn't draw too much of a distinction. But certainly the education has to be appropriate, because when we think about cocaine and we think about its effects on, say, cardiovascular health, its potential effects on negative effects on cardiovascular health, you want to make sure that people who are not cardiovascularly fit, who are cardiovascularly compromised, clearly understand that this might not be a behavior in which you want to engage.
Yeah. Okay. I'd like to shift gears here a little bit in maybe the last third of our conversation and call attention to the memoir dimension of this very engaging book, this very easily to read and gripping story that you've written. You mentioned that, you're a professor of neuropsychopharmacology, professor of psychology and psychiatry at Columbia, but you weren't born a professor at Columbia. It's a very interesting experience to read a book that juxtaposes, on the one hand, a first-person account of coming up hard in, Miami, Hollywood City, projects and, on the streets and all the stuff that's going on, and ending up a tenured professor. Did I read somewhere the first African-American tenured in the sciences at Columbia? Could that be true?
I think that's a reflection.
You finished your degree in 1996. That's like the modern era. There were no blacks tenured in the sciences at Columbia until you came along. That's amazing. Anyway, I'm inviting you to take a few minutes to tell us a little bit about what you might want to share about your story. How do you get from here to there? And what does that, if anything, have to do with the passion that you bring to the discussion of this drug policy question?
Well, I think the important thing about my story, as you know, when you have these kind of stories, people want to put you in these boxes, this sort of up from slavery sort of thing, pull yourself up by the bootstraps. And the thing that I've really tried to resist and try to make sure people understand that my sort of ability to be where I'm at today is really the function of our society and people in our society who helped, including social welfare programs and all of those sorts of things, and good people who helped along the way. So that's what I'll say about that on the one hand. But then on the other hand, having come from where I came from, poor communities, seeing my friends go to jail or be killed at ages that are very young, just gives me a lot more resolve in terms of making sure that the agenda or the interests of poor people is not forgotten in these spaces where I now reside. I think that's one of the things that frustrates me more than anything in these Ivy League spaces is the sort of lack of concern about poor people, really concerned about poor people. Right now, everybody's on the mass incarceration issue. Everyone's on that because it's fashionable. But when we think about the number of people who actually gone in communities and talk to people and see like these jobs that people need, or when we think about the people in these spaces in the Ivy League institutions in these places where we occupy, and then we ask them about diversifying their workplace, see the response that you get then. That's amazing to me. As I'm in these spaces, I hear people talking about mass incarceration. And then these spaces are so, they lack such diversity. It's amazing to me. And people don't even see this as being inconsistent with some of these with these focuses on mass incarceration. And so I'm trying to make sure that I don't forget the people in the communities in which I come from. Because without those people, I'm not me. I'm not able to think about problems in a creative way, in a way that we don't usually think about these problems in the academy. And that's another argument for diversifying the academy. So we can have people think about these problems differently.
Think about them differently, but will they all be qualified? Will they all have mastery of, you know, the technical apparatus of the various disciplines and all of that? That's what our colleagues, I mean, I'm in one of these same places, are going to say. They're going to say, I'd be happy to hire the Latino, African-American, gay, lesbian, transgender person if you could show me the person who can actually do the work.
You know, I am.
I'm sorry, but that's what they're going to say.
You know, I, no, you're absolutely right. But I am so tired of engaging in conversations with disingenuous people. I try to minimize my interactions with those folks. And I have a voice in those spaces, and so do they. And I just try to present a more compelling case in the appropriate fashion. But those kind of arguments, they're going to be there. And I just try and play by the rules of those game of the game that we are in.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I found fascinating in your book was your recounting, you know, you've gone into the Air Force, you've gone to college, you've become a scientist, and now you're returning, you're a faculty member at an Ivy League institution, and you're back in, you know, the community that you grew up in, and you're seeing your family, and you're estranged. Now, correct me if I get this wrong, but what I'm reading in your book is that, you know, it doesn't feel right. You know, you're not able to connect with people. Part of it is you don't talk the same way anymore, and you're self-conscious about it, and you're not willing. I mean, you're perfectly able to code switch back into dialect, but it feels phony and pretentious in a certain kind of way to you. And you don't want to do that. You want to be yourself. And yet you know that you come off as alien and alienating perhaps to people. You don't really think you're better than other people, but you know they're going to think that you think you are and so on. That just, I mean, I thought you put your finger on something that, you know, I could relate to personally. And I, it's really an interesting part of your story, I think.
Yeah, man, I'm still struggling with that part of my story. And the thing I just, 2 weeks ago, I was in Miami back in the hood hanging out. And the things I try to do is shut up and listen and learn in those spaces and try not to be a know-it-all and try not to try and solve problems in the way in which I may do in mainstream. And I just try and learn. It's like relearning all over again. It's taken me a long time to just shut up and try and learn. But it's a struggle.
And who do people think you are? Do they think you're on some kind of, you know, assuage my guilt by coming back home every now and then, that you came from another planet? Do they think you can still relate to the, you know what I mean? Who do they think they're talking to when you're sitting there listening?
Well, you know, one of the things I try to do is try the people who I hang out with, I try and let them know that were not for them, I would not be a productive member of this society. I wouldn't be doing what I do. And I try and point out to many of the people who I hang out with that I try and give them specific examples of how they help push me along and how they save me from many of the ass whoopings in some cases or some stupid sort of things. And so I try to point out those kinds of things to people and let them know how much I value them. Because I've learned over the years that even though I may carry this in my memory, in my heart, my head, they don't know that I'm thinking these things. So I've learned how to say a lot of things like I love you and, you know, things that we just didn't do growing up.
Wow.
And, yeah. And I find that that goes a long way.
I can still recall the scene in your book where you come back and you meet your cousin, Louis.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he's 6 feet tall, weighing maybe 100 pounds.
Yeah.
And you can see every bone in his face and his teeth are falling out.
Yeah.
And you end the scene in tears, weeping. And you're wondering what happened because this was your homeboy. This was the guy that was schooling you. This was your big kind of big brother. He was your cousin. And here you now, and here he now is. And, you know, you're just kind of overwhelmed by it, you know. And,
yeah.
And what was the difference between your life and his? And you mentioned Weideman's beautiful book, Brothers and Keepers, where he asked similar kind of questions about his brother.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, his brother on death row, not on death row, but life in prison in Pennsylvania for some BS. And he is a professor of literature, and they were brothers growing up in the same house.
Yeah. Wyman has influenced me deeply. I mean, in his writing. Yeah. Well, he taught at the University of Wyoming, and I got my PhD from there.
So. Oh, I didn't see that connection. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, but he left right
but before.
But
you didn't
I
overlap. It was no. You were after him, I would
that's
say.
Right, that's right. Yeah. But his ideas and his writing and his thoughtfulness on these issues, I mean, he was lamenting the fact that we have all of these people in prison when there was 600,000 people in prison. And, you know, now we have like 2.3
million. Yeah, I know. You got four times that.
Yeah. And so, you know, I've learned a lot from reading his stuff. But as I think about that chapter on My Cousin Louis, it was one of the most difficult ones for me to write. I mean, and but I was so shocked when I saw him. I hadn't seen him in 30 years. And so shocked that we as a family kind of never really talked about it because we all kind of were embarrassed. And it's like, but we were embarrassed for it wasn't our fault. It's this society. And I tried to make this connection from with My Cousin Louis, what happened with him and what's happening with all of these black boys and men in our society. I tried to make the connection to what happened with black boys in the early 1900s, particularly as it related to cocaine, powder cocaine at the time. And so I tried to let the reader understand that this isn't new. And our sort of apathy in the society is in some ways criminal. And I was that's part of the problem, that we just have this huge amount of apathy because we don't have people in these places that have influence who care about poor people. I mean, I am so disturbed as I have. It's been a year now I've been out here with this book. And I used to think that there were a number of people who cared about poor people because they were a certain race or what have you been. I am becoming more and more saddened by some of our colleagues who I thought were concerned about poor people. But I'm learning that they're more concerned about themselves and their own egos.
Mm. I think that's an appropriate note on which to end this conversation, Carl, but I hope that it will not be the last one we have here at The Glenn Show. I really enjoyed talking to you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Brian, and I'll see you.
Okay, take care now. Bye-bye. Good luck with the book.
Thank you.